Hello and welcome to The Double Pivot, the world's most agreeable soccer analytics podcast. I am Michael Kaley. We are back. I don't know if anyone here has been following the news. I know news from America doesn't like make it around the world sometimes. It's been an eventful week around here. A lot has happened that we are not going to talk about on this podcast. We are, however, going to talk about your questions because we missed a week of podcast. We love you. We want to give you something back. We are going to take a lot of questions, and you gave us a lot of good questions, which makes an easy podcast. Joined by Mike Goodman. How are you recovering? You've been sleeping-ish?
Oh, let me tell you. Starting a new job the day before the election was certainly a choice. The music you heard on the way in was the Whalers. Max is with us on the other side of the virtual glass. Please download, subscribe, make us happy as podcasters. Subscribe to patreon.com/doublepivot, where we'll be doing part two of our great big giant mailbag. Yeah, I'm tired. I'm stressed. I got a cool new job working at CBS Sports, though, so that's cool and fun. So I'm pretty good. Let's answer some questions.
Let's do it. All right, you want to hit me with one?
Sure, I will hit you with a question. There's a whole bunch of like theoretical XG questions, and I think we're going to get to some of them. But let's start off with something a little bit more. If Poch took over Chelsea, as you guys mentioned a few weeks ago, and I will add parenthetically that I do not think this is going to happen. Could he turn Mason Mount into a less violent Eric Lamella? Is there any point to a less violent Eric Lamella? And that's from Dave Gagne.
Yeah, who, I mean, it just to note, in honor of the great Minnesota Twins shortstop, it could be Dave Gagne.
It could be Dave Gagne. That is a fair point.
So what Mason Mount gives you is a very peculiar set of skills, which is that he plays midfield enough to be useful. He can be on the ball in midfield. He does a lot of pressures, a lot of winning the ball, and he gets a reasonable number of shots at the same time. It is a, we talk a bunch about tweeners on this show, guys. If do you do enough of midfield or enough of attacking to be a good player? And because what Mount does is get shots, he does do enough attacking to be a good player as a midfielder. He's not really, I would not consider him to be in the Eric Lamella mold. Lamella is really a like attacking winger who gets shots and then does a lot of violence rather than actually producing a lot of defensive value. The player that Mason Mount is somewhat more similar to is Dele Alli. He doesn't produce as much attacking value as Dele did, but it's the same kind of mix of stuff. And if you wanted to dream on Mason Mount developing into a really good player, I think the best thing you'd hope for is for his shot-getting ability to develop from, you know, a couple shots inside the box and he really likes to shoot from 24 yards into he's getting a bunch of shots from 12 yards in the center, which is what Pochettino developed Dele into. Like, that to me is like what you would sort of dream on with Mason Mount more than Eric Lamella. If he developed him into Dele, he would also be a snide, dangerous player who hurts people. So that would work out for you, but in a different way from Lamella.
It's interesting to me. Clearly, like, the genesis of this question, like, the kernel of it is, like, Mason Mount is a very good defensive presser. Like, he really is, right? He's a very good presser. And Eric Lamella visually kicks people all the time. that's the kernel of it. But what I find sort of fascinating is that, like, Eric Lamella has developed into a player with Spurs that was very different than what they thought they were getting from Roma, where at the time he was this winger getting tons of shots and like great shots and lots of shots, like 4 to 5 shots a game with like a very like high XG average per shot. And it turns out that was like partially Italy, partially this weird Roma system he was playing in at the time. And he developed weirdly into like, what he's developed into is a guy who can be the second best at a lot of things in an attacking unit. Like, he can be your second best presser. He can be your second best creator. He can be your second best shot getter. The problem is if you're asking him to be the best at any particular thing in an attacking unit, he's not good enough to do it. And there's it's a very rare time in which you will have somebody on the field with Lamella who is, you know, at the same time, somebody who's a better shot getter, somebody who's a better creator, somebody who's a better presser. Like, all. And that's kind of what you need to get the most out of Lamella. But, like, Mount, the thing that's interesting to me is he also has this set of skills in the championship where he was getting tons of shots and not doing a lot else. And the question is, does he have a developmental path that gets him somewhere better than Lamella? Whether that's Dele Alli, whether that's adding passing to his game so he becomes more Frank Lampard-y, like, whatever it is because Mount is very young still, and like is clearly good enough to be a Premier League player. But the question is, like, is there a path for him to take this kernel of something and develop into a player? But yes, it is likely not going to be a player like Eric Lamella, because for all his violence, Eric Lamella is not a great presser, and Mason Mount is already a great presser.
All right, so let's stay in the Premier League for a minute. This is a question from Nicholas Marsh. Asks, why has no one rich, like Arsenal, just given Ralph more money to do the thing he does with better players?
It's a fair question. It's not immediately clear to me that won't happen at some point. But I think we need to remember, this is like Ralph's third season with Southampton. Second and a half season, really. And third and a half season? I lose track. Man, it's been a long week. But, like, there has been, like, significant question for the first couple of years with Southampton about whether Ralph was good enough for this. About whether Ralph was going to hang on to his job. Because Southampton kind of, until really, like, last season, Southampton played below their numbers. And it wasn't, like, clear that he was doing a good job, except to us who sat here and were like, they'll be fine. No, really, they'll be fine. No, we expect that they're going to be fine. So I think the public perception of him, right, of House and Hodel has really come around to what we thought it would be. But it is not, like, I think it is somewhat retrofitting, like, what people thought of him to, like, argue that he has always been a well-respected manager at Southampton.
Yeah, I think that, like, on the takes front, like, it's going to, I mean, maybe Southampton will just remain in the top four race all year, and then everyone will realize that they always thought Ralph Hasenhüttl was a great manager. If they end up having a mid-table-ish season, like, it's going to take some, he's still sort of sitting there as a manager that a team that needs a good manager next summer could try to come in with a bunch of money for and grab without having that much competition unless they stay in this top four race. Like, he's still in a very good situation as, like, the Diogo Jota of managers.
Related to the previous question, where are we here? Charles Sangree asks, outside of Danny Ings, are Southampton players actually good, or is Ralph just a genius?
Yeah, and so, like, there are good players here, and there also are players with a very particular set of skills.
The team of Shea Liam
Adams
Neeson's?
Looks like just a. Sorry,
the team of Liam Neeson's.
Yeah, exactly.
The fighting Neeson's.
The fighting Neeson's.
Yes, it is a. Yeah. Now, the question is always, like, these things, is it a well-constructed team? Or has House and Huddle done an incredibly good job of finding roles for all these players with specific skills?
Right. So Shea Adams last season really struggled to finish chances. And this season is doing a better job of that while also sort of doing more creation for Ings, because he's really playing Adams and Ings together. Ings is now going to be out for a little while, but so it'll be interesting to see how they manage with just Adams. They've also got this, like, crazy midfield of one guy who just kicks people in Romeu, yep, and one guy who just hits amazing free kicks in Ward-Prowse, and he's getting just enough pressing and defensive value out of Ward-Prowse.
And while just Romeo enough is, passing out of Romeo.
Yep. Yeah, and both of them, what they do is they both run around a lot.
Yeah.
And this is a very high pressing system. They get a lot of work out of the fullbacks and wingers. Like Southampton's XG difference is about even right now. Like they are definitely like their points are running ahead of their performances, which like they've deserved for a while. Like, you know, that works. But like what Hasenhüttl is doing is much more getting kind of average performance out of a clearly below average squad than like this right. team looks like top four competitors. And so like the answer really is not that much. There's not that much here.
Yeah.
And
Danny Ings is really good.
Like Southampton could get him better players. It's not just like Arsenal with their money could get him better players. Southampton can get him better players.
They could. I mean, their talent level has been steadily declining over the last 3 or 4 years. You know, everybody's sort of used to them having sold off their players, but there was a lot more replacing them going on than there has been the last couple of seasons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing I was just looking at today as a Spurs fan, keep checking these things. Kyle Walker-Peters is winning the ball a lot more than he ever used to. Like, he's still not like a plus defensive fullback, but he does appear to be a fullback, and he is a good ball progressor. Like he's developing young talent there as well. It's just Hasenhüttl's just good at his job.
All right, you want to hit me?
All right. So, how about we move over to Europe for a minute? Because I thought this was an interesting one. This is from Melindy Johnson. Asks, is João Félix taking the leap? / are Atletico the best team in Spain?
You know, I hadn't realized quite how good Atleti were. And then I was talking with somebody over at CBS about, like, who is the fourth best team in Europe? And he was like, well, maybe it's Atleti. And I was like, nah. And then I looked at the numbers, and it's like Real Sociedad are still the best team probably in La Liga by the numbers. But, like, if you were to look at the teams who you might think a priori were good, like, Atleti's right there. And, like, kind of on the back, João Félix. So, maybe? Right?
Yeah, so, like, João Félix is, if you want a guy, like, right now he is, in my numbers, he is leading La Liga in XG plus XA per 90. He's getting about 3 shots per 90. He's assists about 2 shots per 90. He's also leading La Liga in goals and assists per 90. So this is no like crazy thing. He's finishing extremely well, but that's not like that weird. And he's on the ball a ton.
That's the thing, yeah.
That's the really big change from previous seasons. Is that he's now completing about 35 passes per night at a high rate. He's always been a clearly like highly technically skilled player, but he wasn't sort of getting involved in that way. And so the dribbling is still there, but now the passing is there. That means the ball progression is there. He's like in a system that doesn't play the ball into the penalty area that much. He's completed 1.5 passes in the penalty area per 90. A lot of progressive. Like it's all there right now. When I look at somebody who's got as much like expected assists sitting there as he does, got like 2.5 expected assists and 2 assists. Often, like you're like, okay, that's gonna drop down a little. That tends to even out a little more quickly, and that would knock some of his numbers down. But at the same time, he's on the ball a ton.
Right.
And he's got guys in Correa and in obviously Suarez to pass to. Like, it's kind of a... You can kind of see it.
Yeah, I think so, too. I am just, like, skeptical that, like, this team will continue. Like, I believe more in Felix, as, in João Félix, as a player who is becoming very, very good at a very young age. than I do in Atleti being a really good team right now. I just, like, I've seen these stretches from Atleti over the years where it looks like they're like, yes, the defense is what it is. It's always great. It's always good. But, like, I've seen the seven-game stretches of attack where you're like, oh, they're opening up the throttle this year. They're trying to be a complete team. They think they're going to win the league. And then it always comes back, right? Like, it just always comes back. So I am a little bit skeptical from that regard. But I'm not, like, the Felix numbers seem real to me.
And I guess my question is, like, you know, so that's sort of taking them down from, like, okay, they could be fourth in the world. But could they be the best team in La Liga anyway?
Yeah, it's possible. Like, like, I think very early on in the season, we looked at Atleti and we're like, well, this is not the team that is going to jump over the two teams, even though the two teams are having down years. And I don't necessarily feel that way now, because Madrid have gotten worse, Barcelona haven't gotten better, and Atleti are still somewhat better, and Atleti are then to some degree better than we thought they were early on. As we've gone from, like, three games to, like, eight games. So, you know. Yes, they could be.
Yeah.
And at this point, they could not be the best team in La Liga and still win La Liga. Is I think, like, necessary when you're looking at the speed with which Madrid and Barcelona are racking up the drop points.
Yeah, that part is wild.
Yeah, that to me is, like, I don't know, like... I don't know, man. Like,
yeah, because the thing about Barcelona is, like, we've been talking down Barcelona for a while. They're not this bad. They're in eighth, and they are not, like, they have been playing, like, the second, third, fourth best team in La Liga.
Right. I mean, the thing that's notable about all of them, right, is that, like, not that they're worse than a lot of teams. It's just like there's no separation between them and Atleti and Sociedad. Like, that's like, you know, Sociedad and Atleti are a little bit better right now, but it's not like massive amounts. There's it's not like those two teams are like, oh my god, they're mid-table teams. It's just like points-wise, it's been a mess, but like performance-wise, they're just like, when you're running even with some other teams, performance-wise, and you have a bad stretch, this is what happens. Whereas, like, when you were what Real Madrid and Barcelona were, you could have a bad stretch, and you would be in second.
Right. And so Atletico Madrid now, because Atleti and Barcelona are still only have played seven games.
Right.
Atleti have 6 points on Barcelona.
Yeah. That's all, I mean,
like, it's not easy to say that this Barcelona team is... I would not say that this Barcelona team is likely to make up 6 points on Atletico Madrid over the rest of the
not
season.
Not on average, no.
And that's a nice bump to have when you're trying to win La Liga.
Yes. All right. Let me ask you an easy one from Satya Pratik.
All right.
Has Kylian Mbappe gone nuclear yet?
That, like, happened a couple of years
ago.
Yeah,
exactly. Yes. He went nuclear a couple of years ago, and we are all living in you know, post-Mbappe nuclear holocaust. We are in the bombed-out wasteland of Mbappe.
Yeah, like, it happened 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Two seasons ago is the season where Mbappe started putting up XG numbers that were just completely inhuman. And this year, they're even a little bit better in the limited minutes that he's played.
I would say the worrying
thing
is that...
He's at 1.5 XG plus XA per 90, whereas previously he's been at, like, 1.2. But he made the jump to over 1, solidly over 1 XG and XA per 90 in Liga play. About a season and a half ago.
I would say if you're going to look for, like, things to be worried about, it's that injuries are starting to creep in. And, like, I don't know, man. When you're this much better than everybody else and you're young and you're in Paris, like, part of what makes the best players in the world the best players in the world is that they have not only the explosive ability, but the attention to career and attention to professionalism and attention to the craft to have a body that maintains the rigors of this for 10 to 15 years. And know, maybe it's nothing with Mbappe. Maybe he's just had a couple of weird fluky injuries and it's fine. But like, when you're talking about a guy with the skills and performance and output of Mbappe, and you get to the point where when he's like 21, 22 years old, the question is not how great will he be? The question is, what are the things that could happen that would end up with him not being great? And the list is really short. And it's basically like fluke injury or lack of professionalism. Like, right, like that's the entire list.
Yeah, like we talked on we killed Joshua Kimmich, and we're sorry about that.
Yeah, my deepest levels of apology.
We talked about how amazing he is, but like the simple answer to who's the best player in the world is just Kylian Mbappe. Yeah. And just is.
It is indeed.
And it's not because he's gotten better this year, it's because Messi seems to be getting worse.
Right.
All right. So that's a fun place to be. So got a question here. We got on possible U.S. men's team player, although possibly also not. This is from Matt M. Asks, what's the deal with Yunus Musa?
Yeah. So I'm a soccer professional. I was not at all aware of this kid's existence until, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago. But if you are not at all aware of this kid's existence, of a 17-year-old American national, possibly, he's got some other options, who plays... who plays for Valencia and is starting games and has been called up to the men's national team during this international break, you would might enjoy reading the CBSSports.com website come probably Monday, where we will have a piece about said kid and talking to a bunch of people involved in his development and his time at Valencia and what makes him special and why, like, this is a kid that came out of nowhere and is now playing, like, regularly for Valencia, which is like no mean feat. And so, you know, there's a great, it is an interesting time in men's soccer, in U.S. men's soccer, right? Because we have all of these young, really talented kids who are playing. But there was a time not long ago when if like you were 17 and you got on the field for Valencia, you were the thing. Like, you were the great American hope for soccer in the future, and you could not fail. You could only be failed, and the entire future of our nation as a soccering nation depended on you. None of that is the case anymore, any longer, really, which is why, like, he can just show up and be playing for Valencia, and I have good content to run about him. So, yes, exciting.
Yeah, so that part is cool, and he's, like, really young. And so I was like, okay, let's see what's going on with this kid's numbers. And like, so I haven't really watched Yunus Musa play. There are statistical, like, ways of evaluating players based on their numbers are relatively limited. You want to mix together scouting and stats, but my God, this is the worst statistical, like, page I've ever seen on a player. I'm so sorry. So he's played like 600 plus minutes. He's got like a significant number of minutes. Again, that's the impressive part. But he's attempted 2 shots and assisted 3. He's playing as a winger. He is averaging 1.4 take-ons, successful take-ons per night. He's only completing 40% of those. He is only playing about 22 passes per 90, and he's only completing about 16, so under 75%. He's not moving the ball forward. He wins the ball like a bit more than a typical winger at like 2.5 tackles, interceptions per 90, but like he's not on the ball. He's not doing anything with the ball when he gets the ball. He's definitely not getting on the end of chances or getting toward the end of chances. He's not really moving the ball forward for his team. He doesn't seem to be doing a lot of pressing or defensive work. Like, I don't know. Like, it kind of looks like somebody who's not supposed to be playing senior minutes at 17 and is playing senior minutes at 17 because he's at Valencia and Valencia is a garbage fire. Hopefully it'll turn around. Maybe he's learning something. Maybe he's little. There's nothing.
The thing
there.
Is, right, is if you are a kid who is not supposed to be playing senior minutes at 17 and you don't play senior minutes at 17. And then you show up at 19 as a kid who's supposed to be playing senior minutes at 19 at Valencia. Like, that's an encouraging prospect. So if that's the profile, that's fine. Like, that's good. And like the fact that like I can sort of say that like lots of scouts and those kinds of people are very excited about this kid. Are like sort of frustrated that he may end up picking the United States as opposed to other international team setups. I suppose I'm a company man, so I shouldn't mention that Sid Lowe also has a long piece on him over on ESPN.com. But he does. You can read about it. You can read about people saying that he is special and unique and, you know, that he is the bee's knees. So maybe it is just that he's, like, ahead of where he's supposed to be. And, like, wasn't quite to this degree, but a year ago, like, we kind of said about Ansu Fati, it's nice that he's 16 and he's playing senior minutes, but there's not much there. And then Ansu Fati was having a really good year this year, a year later, before he died. So, you know, and ripped up his leg. So there is, like, yeah, you gotta be careful when they're not putting up numbers at this age. But then there's also, like, the Reese Oxfords of the world, who are just, like, inappropriately put on the field at a very young age and aren't that good and never actually become any good. It's hard to tell. It's easy to tell when you got a young kid and he's putting up average numbers, and then, or even like somewhat below average numbers, and then you're like, oh, okay, not good now, probably will be good. When they're putting up nothing, it's harder to differentiate. All right. My turn to ask you, I suppose.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting one. From Asher Coleman. Why have so many of Europe's biggest clubs, like Real, Barca, Juve, and Man City, struggled to replace their aging stars? Is the generation of players born from 85 to 90 an outlier in quality, or have the super clubs gotten worse at buying superstars? If you believe the latter is the case, why is that the case? I would think increased analytics information would in some ways make it easier to find the players who are actually great. Also, why can Bayern still rely so much on Lewandowski and Müller, but keep getting better?
Yeah, so
kind of
I mean,
a cascade of questions there.
There's a lot of questions here and a lot of different pieces of it. I think an important one to sort of pull at first is the fact that Bayern are still great.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have some, I think that the German league system is something of a plus for them in that they get to develop players out of this extremely large country with good football development in it and get sort of first dibs on a lot of them. But they just continue to develop great players and add them into the setup. And
yeah,
like,
I mean,
it's
like, you know, Philip Lahm rotates out and Kimmich rotates in. Like,
yep. And most incredibly, and like, you know, Robin and Ribéry rotate out, and Gnabry and Sané and Coman rotate in. Like, that's worked out really well, and Gnabry's worked out better than I expected to, and they've developed it well, and they've continued to play like a similar kind of pressing style. Like, you know, it can be done. I think one thing that is interesting to me here is in particular Real and Barca, and not if I wanted to sort of like come up with an explanation beyond just like, you know, those teams should try being smarter and not as dumb, is that it is hard to replace not like a generation of talent, but like the GOAT and the second GOAT.
Yeah.
Like, that is a different kind of problem than simply turning over a great team.
It's also a different kind of problem because you are always going to be making suboptimal minimum long-term decisions in the final years with them to maximize their last years of greatness, which will make the subsequent project even harder. And then sometimes you'll be Real Madrid and delude yourself into thinking you'll get better by doing nothing to replace them, which is like look, people inside the game really honestly believed these two things. Cristiano Ronaldo is one of the two best players in the world. Real Madrid will be better next year because Cristiano Ronaldo is gone. Now, as far as I am concerned, those two things are utterly, utterly impossible to exist at the same time. Just totally incompatible. But this is what people believed. And I would say that, like, Real Madrid are, like, right at this very moment a mess. But, like, they've really restocked with a lot of talent. You know, there was at the dawn of analytics in, like, 2011 or whatever. There was kind of this theory that maybe, like, superstars were a little bit overrated. And that you could add a lot of pretty good players, and you know, you could subtract the superstar and upgrade five spots from average to pretty good and pretty good to good, and you would come out ahead. And what I think we've seen pretty conclusively in the almost decade since then is that the opposite is true. Is that having a superstar such that they move the opposition around in ways that makes everybody else better is more valuable than having a bunch of pretty good players. So what you have to do is, even if you can't find it, like, you're not going to find the next Messi, but you have to find somebody who can be a superstar.
Like Neymar?
Yeah, well, there is that. There is that. So.
But yeah, I mean, I think when you look at Bayern, you know, and the question mentions, like, how are they still, they're still depending on Lewandowski and Müller, or both, like, early 30s. And, like, the thing is, like, Lewandowski is an amazing player. He's been a great, great striker. But, like, and they didn't go for Werner. But, like, if they'd gotten Werner, like, they just have another great striker. And, like, guys come... If you have all the money in the world and dominance over a particularly footballing market, you can get, like, that, like, 0.8 XG for 90 striker, like, because he's going to come along. What you're not going to get is someone getting, like, 6 shots per 90 or someone who's just, like, impossibly great at everything.
Right. Yeah,
and that is the problem that Real Madrid and Barcelona have found themselves in.
Now, Real Madrid and Barcelona have the kind of money where they should be able to go, like, get, like, 4 very good players like Bayern have. But I do think it's harder than it seems like. Like,
yeah. Although I really don't want to undersell how terrible Barcelona's business has been.
Yes.
Like, it's really been, like, Real Madrid's business, I think, has been weaker than it could have been, and so far they're not getting the value out of it. On top of that, like, you Luka Jovic, like, where are the shots? Come on, let's see some Luka Jovic. But, like, Barcelona just did a terrible job of buying even very good players.
Yeah, they really did. You know, the one that you look at and you're like, why didn't this work or hasn't this worked yet is Frankie de Jong. But then you look at the other ones, they were all, to one degree or another, fairly predictable. So, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. And the other part of this question is, like, wouldn't analytics make them better? And the answer to that is yes. Yes, it would.
I mean, look at Liverpool. Right? Look at Liverpool. Like, analytics would just make them better if they just bought younger players. Really good younger players instead of Griezmann of questionable ability nearing the end of his window. Right? Like, you're just in better shape even if you miss on De Jong than if you miss on Griezmann. Yep. And, like...
And look at Leti spending, like, impossibly large amounts of money on João Felix. Like, that was, like, kind of too much. And it didn't hit immediately, but, like, you've got a guy who can develop into a truly great player and may be doing that now.
Absolutely. That's right. Like, yeah. You do that instead of Griezmann. And, like, they did some, like, a little bit, but, like, the problem is also, like, you have to be a team where that can succeed. And, like, look what happened to Ousmane Dembele. And, like, I know some of that is injury and some of that is attitude and everything, but, like, he's also not really gotten the shots when he's been healthy. And, like, I don't know. Do you remember when they bought Marlon for no apparent reason? And that was obviously terrible, and then he never played, and then they shipped him off to Russia? Like, what are we doing? Anyway. It's my turn to ask you a question.
Yeah, I think so.
No, oh, no, I asked you that question, and then we just ranted for a while about teams being bad.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, here's one on, this is from Ray Sales. It's just Ray's first question. is Man City's lack of attacking output put a terminal issue, or can it be easily solved? And if it can be solved, what needs to change? Differing tactics, personnel changes within the current squad, something else.
Okay, I will let you get away with not asking this first question. That is his second question. To the extent that Manchester City have a lack of attacking firepower, it is a choice. And the reason that they have made that choice is because they were having tremendous amount of trouble defending counterattacks. The sort of the Fernandinho check finally bounced. They have this season not been able to figure out a way to be, they had gone from being playing incredibly attacking and not allowing counterattacks at all to playing even more attacking and allowing an acceptable amount of counterattacking to being truly vulnerable on the counterattack over the last three seasons. And so they've changed. And what they are doing is they are playing a much more conservative style of possession where they are seeking to control the ball a lot more. Still create great chances, but not, you know, they were trying to create great chances and a lot of chances, on the theory that, well, we can, like, be very aggressive and we'll just win the ball back immediately if we lose it, and if we don't win the ball back immediately when we lose it, Fernandinho will stop the other team from counterattacking. Or then, if not Fernandinho, some weird combination of Rodri and Gundogan and Kyle Walker, I guess. and then this year, that part had stopped. So now it's like, well, we don't want to lose the ball if the chance isn't great. And that is what they are turning into, a team that wants to really control the ball and take great chances instead of take great chances and lots of other chances. And it seems to me to be a reasonable trade-off, but it has a lower ceiling, I think, for success.
Yeah. And then on top of that, they are not really succeeding at getting great chances from what they're doing.
Now, I would say a lot of that has been injury stuff.
Yeah.
Aguero has barely been in the lineup. Gabriel Jesus is kind of like just back. They finally settled on like Ferran Torres being the fake striker in that group, and it seemed like that was a decent solution that they came up with. But like, to me, the issue, like, I don't think there's structurally something wrong with the more controlled attack that is not a personnel thing, and that a healthy Jesus combined with Ferran Torres getting more minutes in that role can't fix. And I think it is probably the smarter decision for them going forward.
Yeah, like the right now they are. It's really striking how the like the attacking output of all of these guys is down. Yeah. You know, Sterling has been like a 0.8 goals and assists per 90 guys down to 0.4. Mahrez has seen the exact same drop in his numbers. De Bruyne hasn't. He's still amazing. But like they're just with, and it's sort of hard to say how much is like they really expected to have someone like Aguero to play off of
or Messi.
But like they hope to have that. But like in the past, they've been playing off of Aguero or sometimes Jesus, and like just creates enough gravity that there's more space there. To what degree are like? Is this slowed down game making it harder for those guys to get the shots that they want? You know, to what degree is Mahrez, for example, going to be 30 pretty soon?
Yep.
And not quite the same. Like, there's a lot of different pieces here that, like, it is the it is clearly the case that a big part of what's going on here is that they are choosing to slow down, and it hasn't yet worked. One of my questions is, is choosing to slow down the only thing that is making a bunch of their players a little bit worse? Or, like, are some of these players just a little bit worse than they were? And is Ferran Torres, like, not a great replacement for the players that they had?
Yeah, it's fair. So let me throw another one at you in this vein, as long as we're talking about Manchester City. City just sold Douglas Luiz to Aston Villa. This is from Christopher Boyd. Whilst looking like they need defensive midfield help, was that a mistake? Is Luiz any good?
Ah, Douglas Luiz, my my old nemesis. I don't understand, like, what is... So, in some ways, this is an Aston Villa question. Because, like, one of the things that's going on in the Premier League right now is that Aston Villa is good. And Douglas Luiz continues to be a central midfielder on a team that is somewhat inexplicably good, who doesn't win the ball, who doesn't have, like, significant pressure numbers. The other thing about Douglas Luiz is that he isn't on the ball very much. He's only completing, like, 28 passes per 90 on a team that doesn't have, like, particularly low possession numbers. He's a weird one. It is very hard for me to see the case that Douglas Luiz is the part of Aston Villa's team that makes the balance work.
I guess a good way to maybe approach this question is, like, it's November 11th as we record this. So we're about a month and a half away from a transfer window. If a month from now you heard a rumor that a Champions League competing caliber club was in for Douglas Luiz for 45 to 55 million, what would your reaction be to that?
My reaction would be, I leave open the possibility that he is doing something that is not visible in the numbers, because, again, Aston Villa being pretty good defensively is very confusing to me. But, man, that is a thin reed to hang 50 million pounds.
Yeah, my reaction would be, I'd really want to laugh a lot and say this is ridiculous, they shouldn't do it, and it'd be a failure. And I would, like, come back around to, like, trying to be exceedingly fair and unjudgmental and making this, like, maybe there's something we don't see case. And then in 2 years being really mad at myself that I wasn't firmer and calling it a flop. Like that is what I feel like with him right now.
Yeah, like, the problem that Manchester City have that they didn't try to replace Fernandinho is not really a problem that is captured in not retaining Douglas Luiz.
Yeah.
It is a problem that is captured in spending an incredibly large amount of money on Rodri, who is not similar to Fernandinho, and then not doing anything else.
Yeah.
Like... Now, finding a player like Fernandinho, we've talked about this before, finding a player like Fernandinho is hard, and I don't think there really is a player in the world right now who really reminds me of Fernandinho at his peak. Joshua Kimmich, because he's incredible, does a lot of what Fernandinho did at his peak, not quite all of it, but a lot of it while also doing other things, which is amazing. Like, this is a limited set of players. Like, Denis Zakaria is the one that I've come back around to a couple of times, and he was injured this summer, and Manchester City are now interested in him. But, like, they could have just, like, you know...
It is interesting, though, and I don't know whether it's like, the tactical moment we're in, or, like, you know, how something has changed in development, but there was a generation of midfield, of, like, Fernandinho is, like, but, like, you look at guys like Sergio Busquets, you look at guys like even, like, Xabi Alonso or Javier Mascherano before he moved back to center back. Like, you had a generation of guys at center back who were rangy destroyers, and this is a little bit unfair to Busquets, but who are, like, rangy destroyers who also could pass. And then, like, the balance of those things, like, okay, you might say Xabi Alonso was a little more towards the passing side, and Mascherano was a little more towards the destroying side, and Busquets was... But there were, like, a number of these guys. And there are less of them now. or there are less of them playing in positions for teams now. I don't know if, like, 10 years ago, somebody like a Hakimi would have been in that role as they developed instead of developing as a fullback. I don't know if just the game has changed in such a way where, with so much pressing, those guys, there's just not a demand for developing those players. But it sure seems to me like there's just a dearth of those players. And I don't really know what to make of that.
Yeah, you know, here's a crackpot theory, because I was sort of thinking about, like, okay, who are the players now that you could, and these players are like, again, these are more like peak, late peak players. But the guys I think about when I try to come up with players to fit that are Thiago Alcantara and N'Golo Kanté.
Yeah.
Both of whom, at their peaks, are absolutely incredible. Both of them have a lot of injuries.
Yeah, that's true.
The one thing I wonder about is whether this role just is impossible. Well, whether, like...
But, I mean, like, it wasn't for that previous generation.
Yeah, one thing I wonder is whether we have, like, whether, like, it's just ticked up enough in terms of the intensity of play that, like, muscles and ligaments and joints can't do it anymore.
It's possible. I mean, I don't know why that would be the case, but, like, wingers, that wouldn't be the case, you know? I don't know. I think it's an interesting... I also, like, I kind of wonder whether, like... Just a lot of guys who end up being free eights. Like, you know, would Alan in another career have been that, maybe? You know, that kind of a question.
Yeah, I mean, Alan at his best at Napoli was, like... doing all those
right,
I mean,
as was like
as best at Napoli, Alan was pretty close to Fernandinho.
Right, but he was never the but he was always playing as an eight with like Jorginho there. Yeah. And like, you know, that's kind of also like the same thing about like Vidal at his peak. Well, so we left out Yaya Toure, who like at his best was one of those sixes who could do everything before he got, you know, like it's sort of like the enduring memory of him for Premier League fans is kind of when he's a little bit older and less in shape and slower, and he's like a designated hitter, like scoring goals for Manchester City. But like in his prime, you know.
Yeah, this was that was our like Kimmich comparison. Right, like yeah. the guy who does all of those things while also being a great creator and a great ball striker who gets like a significant yeah. number of shots. Yeah. Like it's impossible how good he was. Yeah.
Anyway, all right. We have a whole bunch of theory questions, which we're going to get to on the subscription side, because I think some of them are pretty interesting about XG and sort of how we think about some of these things. You want to do one more here? I forget whose turn it is.
Yeah, let's do a little bit of theory. You want pick one out?
Okay, I'll pick one theory question out to get everybody, you know, give everybody a little taster here. Oh, here's a fun one, because it's not linked into the... It's a Liverpool question in disguise, thinly. Similar to the how much will results suffer when you take out a team's best player? Except now it's an entire position. This is from Jason Cho. What is a team's ceiling if it doesn't have any center backs?
I think that, like, this is in... This is a replacement level question, a certain way. This is a question like, so, you know, Liverpool, in ways that we can perhaps get into in more specifics in another podcast, like Liverpool have center backs. They have Joel Matip and they have like
kids. They have Joel Matip and they have kids.
And once you start, like, one thing that we don't have, like, a really good handle on, bunch of different ways into this. So, replacement level is a concept that was developed in baseball, and in baseball teams have, one, baseball players' value is, like, pretty easy to estimate. Like, you can get... you can get it wrong, but if you've got like a really large group of different players, you've all got to all dump them together, and you can then pretty well estimate like what they provide for you. And so, and then in baseball, you can pretty well determine like who are, and then each team has a farm system of players. So they've, so you know who the players are at the next level down, who are all the players who are not good enough to make the major league rosters and are just the next level down. Okay, so what, and then when those players pop up briefly because someone, like, our both of our second basemen are injured and we need a utility second baseman, okay, we'll call up this 28-year-old rando from AA, and he puts up a 600 OPS, and like, okay, like, you put all those guys together, mash them all together in this huge sum, like, okay, you're getting about a 600 OPS, and we can sort of, like, estimate what the value of that is on offense. Like, and that gives you a sense of what the replacement level is. The problem is that in soccer has a bunch of problems trying to get there. One of them is just the simple fact that OPS doesn't exist. But you know, you can imagine some sort of like what American Soccer Analysts created with G+. Like you could kind of put some kind of number together like that. It's not going to be, baseball is easier to do, but you can kind of imagine that. The other problem is, who exactly are those players? Because you don't have AAA. There is this huge, like, weird inefficiency in soccer. You're going to be calling players up from a youth team, which is not the level down below the Premier League. The level down below the Premier League is like the Championship, or maybe it's League One, and some of your players be on loan there, but like, those are your better youth players. Other youth players you're going to keep around, like, how many of them are sort of that level? So the players you bring in are going to be of extremely variable quality. While in Major League Baseball, there's a relative amount of efficiency that, like, those can be similar players. Like, if you happen to have a youth center back who is championship quality, that makes it way, way easier than if you don't. And if you've chosen to send that player on loan to for their development, that suddenly makes it harder. Like, so
there's a secondary thing here too, positionally, which is that because positions are somewhat more mutable, I have no idea which not center backs on Liverpool might be Championship or League One level center backs, which might actually place them above the youth level and might make it worth it. Like, I don't know. Like, is Gini Wijnaldum just going to, like, slot in at center back and be bad, but, like, not that bad? Right? Like, I could have asked that question about Trent, I suppose. You can't really ask it about Robertson. He's tiny. But, he's Scottish. I'm sorry, he's Scottish. He's wee. but, like, I was joking around on Twitter about, like, James Milner. But, like, how bad a center back would James Milner be compared to a youth center back? It's super variable. How bad, like, if I told you right now that James Milner was starting a League One game at center back tomorrow, would you say to me, oh, he's going to be super outclassed? I don't know. But there's more unknowns when you get into this sort of idea. But I mean,
and it becomes a situation where, like, it really depends on the manager and the team's evaluation of things in training. Right. That, like, okay, this set of skills that we've seen from this player are going to work. And center back is a particularly interesting one, I think, because the set of skills you need at center back, some of them don't really show up when you're playing other positions.
Yeah. And also they vary a lot depending on how you play. Like, this is true across the board, obviously, but, like, James Milner would have an easier time playing center back for Liverpool than for Burnley. Like, or to put it, like, somewhat more broadly, which player who is a good outfield player at a different position would be a below average but maybe acceptable player at center back for you depends greatly on what kind of center backs you need. Like, Burnley, like, would want a, like, you would sooner see like Chris Wood be an emergency center back for Burnley than you would somebody like a James Milner or like a small fullback, right? Like Cesar Azpilicueta plays like center back sometimes for Chelsea. You would see Chris Wood play center back for Burnley before you would see Azpilicueta because of the various different things that they need to do. So there's a lot of variables there. All of which is like, I don't think Liverpool is like dead by any means, but how they solve the problem is going to be as much about their internal evaluations of things that we don't have access to. And there's an incredible amount of variance in it. But like, if there's a group of like decision makers, you expect to get those internal variables right. Like, is there any club you'd have more faith in getting them correct than Liverpool?
Right. And then the other part of it is like, because of the incredible dynamism of the game. If you have a center, if you have a guy who can be like 85% of a center back, and you just need to find like, okay, we just need to squeeze 15% of a center back out of our tactics.
Right.
Like, what do we do a little bit different in midfield? What do we do a little bit different on the wing so we can manage the fact that James Milner is like, you know, if you have James Milner at center back, like, and he's surely not going to be the deep lying center back, but he's also like not that mobile because he's old. Like, you're going to have to like contain a play a little, use a little bit more mobility from the way your fullbacks defend, from the way your midfield tacks work, and then and so all of these become like little knock on pieces that are not easily sort of contained in a more straightforward vision of replacement level that you're going to have to deal with when you're solving this problem for a specific team.
There you go. All right. We'll be back doing more philosophical stuff on the subscription side, talking about expected goals and whatnot.
Yeah. And possibly Liverpool. I don't know.
Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.